Hello, and welcome to another episode of Untied Methodism, where we unravel the past to make sense of today. I'm your host, Dr. Ashley Bogan, the General Secretary of Archives and History, and joining us again is Reverend Dr. Emily Nelms Chastain. If you missed our live podcast, be sure to check it out. Me and Emily had a lot of fun sitting in the same room, dealing with technology and discussing what actually happened at the 1956 General Conference. But Emily, we brought you back today to talk about two things specifically. One is kind of this post-1956, where women in ministry have the audacity to dare to start to try to think about becoming a bishop. And the second is one of our pioneers within women's Methodist history, and that is Jean Audrey Powers. But let's dive in with bishops. So Emily,
yeah.
After 1956, I mean, what all those men predicted was going to happen, that one day women might think that they too could be a bishop. How did we get there?
Yeah, it was not quick. You know, and 1956, you know, I don't know if folks listened to the last one. There were like 300 people that were already ready to be commissioned, or 300 women that were already ready to be commissioned, ordained. One of those who gets commissioned in 1956 is Jean Audrey Powers. She is ordained in 1958. And so women are just filling into these spaces. But, you know, in the mid to late 60s, they start like realizing that like women aren't getting elected. And in fact, my favorite story from my master's thesis that I found was that there's a judicial council decision that comes in 1972 because they put Peggy Billings' name on the list in the Southeast jurisdiction. Problem was, she was a layperson. So in 1972, the judicial council like gives the ruling like, no, only elders can be nominated or elected for bishops. So unfortunately, even our women's division couldn't break that one. But the women's division was pivotal in this work yet. They were pivotal in this work to fight for women bishops. And it all comes out of, once women are getting ordained, there is a predecessor to the General Commission on the Status and Role of Women. It's actually called the Commission on the Status and Role of Women, named after President Kennedy's Commission on the Status of Women. And they're functioning in these ways to kind of try to build some guardrails for the church. And in 1968, when the Methodist Church and the Evangelical United Brethren Church are merging, they propose two agencies to look at this work, and that is the Commission on Religion and Race and the Commission on the Status and Role of Women. And both of these are study commissions in 1968, so they have these meetings to kind of learn and see what they're doing. And then in 1972, both G. Core and G. Cosgrove become permanent agencies, And a lot of this work comes out of G. Cosgrove. And, you know, you mentioned Jean Audrey Powers. She's present for all this. So I'm not convinced that she's not the, like, catalyst in all of this work, because she works for the United Methodist Church at that point in one of the general agencies. And she just starts getting the ball rolling with, she serves as the first recording secretary of G. Cosgrove. And at that time, they had a like triumvirate of leadership instead of having like a president like we do now of our general agencies. And they start tackling racism, sexism in all its forms. And so you in 68, 72, you really start to see a lot of this moving forward and kind of being put to the forefront. Of course, culturally, this is also in line with the ERA that's coming forward, with the second wave feminism that's coming forward. So similar to Madeline Southard and kind of riding the wave of suffragism of suffrage, you start to see the women of the church taking this second wave feminism and bringing it to the church. So And it is wild. It's a wild ride to go through all these documents.
Are any of them like explicitly invoking the ERA in their arguments? Or
oh yeah, yeah, awesome. Yeah. They actually like the United Methodist Church approves the ERA. Like, there's a resolution that comes forward that says like we support the work of the ERA. It goes like it's kind of a known thing that like women's rights are super important. They just can't crack the episcopacy for some time. And, but yeah, like the G. Cosgrove pushes it, they bring it forward. There's lots of support for it, in the General Conference. Of course, timeline wise, you know, we're also looking at the rise of Good News and the, caucuses that are gonna like push for a more conservative look. So they're gonna start pushing against this ERA feminist tagline in some ways, right? Like they're going to really take, similar to the moral majority movement, they're going to take the issue of abortion and really start pushing it. But no, the United Methodist Church at that time is in full support of the ERA in terms of General Conference.
I mean, that's just fascinating because I don't want to get us too far off topic, but we just now, right, at this last General Conference passed our own version of the ERA to our own constitution. And so it's just, I always love these moments of, I guess, hypocrisy.
I mean, that's a fair word, right? Like this is a beef I have with Georgia Harkness for all of the incredible theology that she wrote, for all of the work that she did, as G. Cosgrove was really pushing for inclusive language. She's like, I don't think you need it. You know, like she's kind of pushing back on some of these things. And so, you know, like I would say, yeah, like it feels hypocritical, but I would also say, like, I think some of it's intentional, but I don't think it's all intentional, right? Like, I do think that they're like, well, yeah, we've used these words like layman, like we've got to put an equivalent in there. And Cosgrove kind of takes the lead for like, how do we insert this inclusive language in there? But you know, I think a lot of us are learning as we move along, right? Like we're reading Feminine Mystique and we're like understanding that, you know, we've been operating in this separate spheres, you know, like women have this, men have this, like it's not, you know, and nearly every woman who is serving as a pastor is just now getting the rights to a credit card when they're like in 1970s, right? Like, so, you know, like this is something that like we're all kind of learning, like where the oppressive areas have been and trying to lift them. And so I want to give them a little bit of grace. I'm not going to give them all the grace, but I want to give them a little bit of grace that like they're trying to lean into it. Because even in like 1972 with Roe v. Wade, is it 1972? 73. Thank you. Like the church is in full support of Roe v. Wade.
And so support of reproductive rights in 1970.
Yeah. So like it's, you know, there are things that, you know, the church is learning and kind of leaning into. And so it's like, you know, it's kind of like, I feel like sometimes, you know, the paragraph four thing, not counting 2016, obviously, but before that, I think it was kind of like, oh snap, we forgot. Like we actually need to include this. Like this is important. Of course, in 2016, it gets mixed into all kinds of political arguments that get misconstrued. But I think a lot of times it's the church learning that omission is also a form of oppression and trying to fix that as they go. And so I'll give them a little bit of grace. But, you know, once they stop fully listening to a lot of the women that are pushing, you know, for women bishops, then it becomes more of an issue.
Yeah. So you're saying that the Women's Division and then G. Cosgrove and G. Core and Jean Audrey Power specifically are kind of the ones pushing all of this forward. What is their, I feel like this is, it's not a rhetorical question, I promise. What is their reasoning? What is their rationale?
I mean, they're building on the same arguments of feminism of second wave, right? They're saying like omission, like means that we have been keeping these people out of these spaces. And if we are going to really lean into our theology that all people are called, then we have to live into making space for these folks in all levels of the church. And so they lean back historically to talk about like the ordination piece, they lean back to historically to talk about how women weren't even allowed to be lay members of General Conference until much later after men. So they're leaning into all of these issues to kind of help strengthen their argument. And so they're still leaning into, you know, the same scriptures, like all men, like there's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female. Like that's what they're talking about when they when they have these arguments. So they're using second wave feminism, but giving it a biblical foundation as well. And Jean Audrey Powers, the reason I think she's so strong in this argument is she's working. So she's also a member of the Association of Women Preachers, which Madeline Southard, two episodes back, started. And all of the women, you know, who fought for ordination in 1956 are all a part of. Jean Audrey Powers is also a part of this group. And so she's working in ecumenical work. And so she's kind of following on the heels of Georgia Harkness and doing a lot of this faith and order work. But she's leaning heavily into worship and providing a lot of these resources that can be read as much more inclusive to all the people that are involved. And so she's watching how all of these meetings are happening within the World Council of Churches to talk about women's ordination. And she's extracting all of this information to kind of also give a data set to kind of look at these other pieces. She's in the Episcopalian conversations for when they get women ordained in 1975. She's actually at the service to honor the Philadelphia 11 when they're ordained. And so, because it happens at Riverside. So it happens like right outside of her office. And so like, she's very much a part of all of these other women that are fighting for the rights, including women religious who are fighting for ordination in the Catholic Church. And so she has her fingers in everything. And so it's really remarkable to see her work with COSRO, with the General Church, with the World Council of Churches, where she's able to keep an eye on all of these conversations that are happening, extracting language that is useful and putting it in other places so that it's helpful to the arguments that they're using.
Wow. That is amazing. And just to clarify, like within the United Methodist Church at this time, like there's no language in the Book of Discipline that says women can't be bishops, because it just says that to be a bishop, you have to be an elder. And that right was granted in 56. So this is really just kind of like a convincing the United Methodist membership and clergy that to actually support a woman and vote for one at the jurisdictional level, at least here in the U.S., the jurisdictional level.
Yeah, that 1956 language, when it says like women are able to be in all levels of the church or all provisions of the traveling ministry, means that they can be bishops too. It's just a matter of putting up someone who is electable and who can take on the task. And actually, Jean Audrey Powers was one of everybody's first picks.
That was going to be
my next pick. Yeah. So she gets nominated in 1976, and she has this very long letter that she reads from the floor in the North Central jurisdiction. And she's like, listen, I appreciate this, but it's not me. I'm not the person who's meant to be the first one in the room. And this is something that they were all very concerned about. They really worried about only electing one in the beginning because they thought that she would be really alone, that the men would kind of create a lot of isolation from that woman bishop. And so in 76, so there's a whole story behind 76 too, right? Where all of the clergywomen in the United Methodist Church get an invitation from Jean Audrey Powers and from COSRO, and this band of women whose names continued to be heard for the next few years because most of them were elected women bishops. They put together the first clergywoman's consultation, and it happens in 1975. They all gather from all over the country in Dallas, Texas in 75 on the heels of an ice storm, which, now that I live in Dallas, can tell you wreaks a lot of havoc on the city. Yes. With an ice storm. All of the roadways are elevated, right? So like you get a bunch of people coming from everywhere trying to drive it. It's nuts. So they didn't have the as expansive of participation as they had hoped. But still, they're getting together to talk about how we advance this. How do we nominate or how do we get women forward to be more DSs? How do we get women on the ballot in 76? And they identified Leontine T.C. Kelly and Marjorie Matthews, both of whom they wanted to put forward, but they couldn't get any traction in 76. So then they meet again in 1979 in Nashville, and they have double the participation, and they decide to put forward Marjorie Matthews and Leontine T.C. Kelly again. And of course, there's a story with Leontine T.C. Kelly that's after 1980, but Leontine is a member in the Southeast jurisdiction, right? So, like, I've read her daughter's biography of Bishop Kelly, and man, that woman endured some patriarchy in the Southeast jurisdiction. And of course, Marjorie Matthews gets put up in the North Central jurisdiction, which is a little bit more friendly because they've already had a few women DSs. So they put together two whole national events to try to get the votes, to help build platforms, build campaign teams, the whole thing to organize for these Episcopal elections in 76 and in 1980.
Wow. So they were more focusing on particular women and not necessarily like, let's do it in this jurisdiction. Because that's what I've always wondered, you know, when we think about kind of the persons or the jurisdiction that has probably elected the most diverse bishops in our United Methodist history, at least it's usually the West. And so I wasn't sure if that was always the case or if the West was, you know, a specific place that was that has been intentionally used in that manner or targeted in that manner. But so Marjorie Matthews is North Central jurisdiction. Tell us a little bit about Marjorie Matthews before we jump to Leontine.
Marjorie Matthews, have you seen a picture of her? Like they've got like her 1980 photo, right? Like, and she looks like the sweetest grandma ever. And so she's had this reputation of being this like very sweet, kind lady, but her papers that are at the archives are so interesting to go through. She wrote several letters when she was working on her PhD at Florida State. She wrote several letters to the district superintendents to ask for an appointment while she was there. And she, like, she knows the discipline. She knows, like, she has rights as a clergywoman. And I mean, Florida worked so hard to try to keep her from being able to be a part of anything. Like, all the letters are like, oh, we're sorry. Like, it's not really our call. You have to, like, ask the bishop. You have to ask the pastors at each of these churches that are close by to see if they have anything. And of course, the pastors are like, no, sorry, we don't need anything, you know, like this. And so, and because of Jean Audrey's work with Cosro, when she is working on her PhD, Cosro has started this talent bank. And this talent bank, which is like binders of women, right? If you want to go back to like the phrase that tickled everybody.
Thanks, Ernie.
Yeah. These binders of women, right, that are like, that Cosro has just collected. They're like, fill out all this information. And when these things come forward, we're going to put your name forward to these general agencies and these churches and all this kind of stuff as they're looking for these things. And so she reaches out, she gives her information, and then they're looking for a general secretary, and she applies. So she applies in 1976 for G. Cosro. And so she's very aware of what's happening in these moments. She's very much a little pistol that is, you know, once she finishes her PhD in Florida, she moves back up to the North Central jurisdiction. She's originally from Michigan. She becomes a district superintendent. And then when she's getting ready for the 1979 clergy women's consultations, she sends a letter to every clergy woman in the West Michigan conference, and says, hey, this is an important consultation, and I am trying to put together some resources so that any woman who wants to go can go. And I'm inviting you to go with me to this consultation in 1979. And so she's a very quiet feminist, right? Like, she's not like Jean Audrey Powers, who's very vocal about being subversive in the church. She knows the rules and she's going to abide by them, and she's going to do everything in her power to put this together. And so when they're looking for somebody in the North Central jurisdiction, she's like, well, I'll put my name forward. Like, that's fine with me. And at this 1979 consultation, like, they all meet as jurisdictions. So, like, they are all creating their organizing mechanisms. And who is her campaign manager that comes forward? Sharon Zimmerman Rader, who we know now as another bishop who gets elected in 1988, I think. And so, like, you, and at this meeting in 1979, you've got Janice Rigel Huey, who gets elected in the South Central jurisdiction. I mean, it's like, it's just like this name fest. If you're a historian of women in the United Methodist Church, you're just watching all these names and going, holy moly, like, they've put together, like, Cosro and Jean Audrey Powers and all these have put together the mechanisms to get, like, all of the strongest women together in the same room to literally, like, be in a room where it's going to happen, right? Like, and to put all these things together. It's quite impressive.
You've now given me a new, like, destination for when they make Time Machine. I want
right?
to go there.
No, this is for real. I always want to just go to the 60s. And I'm like, no. Like, I think the 70s are actually pretty rad. Yeah. Like, right before I was born. Like, let's go back to 1979 to Nashville and, like, see what happened before Ronald Reagan got elected. You know, like, I just think it would be really interesting, right? No, it's fascinating to see the women who are speaking at this event. They're becoming district superintendents. They're becoming bishops. Like, Cosro is giving this platform for them to be known so that their name can be shared when these women are going back to their annual conferences. And of course, with the talent bank as well, they're building the resources so that there can't be an excuse of, oh, we didn't know. Because Cosro comes back and says, actually, we have this list and we sent you these names. And so when there are openings for deans at these different seminaries or professors or any of these things, like, Cosro, like, they're reaching out and Cosro's like, here's this list and here's all the information we have on these people. We would recommend these folks and give you these names to talk to about any further recommendations. And so they're like tearing the wall down as they go and leaving no room for any excuse except patriarchy.
Wow. That is absolutely amazing. So in 1980, right, for those who don't know, right, jurisdictional conference happens after general conference, and jurisdictional conferences are only a U.S. thing. So we're in the North Central jurisdiction. Marjorie Matthews has been doing all of this kind of on the ground work, getting her name out. So has Cosro. They've been supportive of all of this. What does that jurisdictional conference look like? Like, I'm assuming she's not elected on first ballot.
Jurisdictions all meet in July, right? So they've been meeting. Marjorie Matthews is not the first one elected. She is, however, elected a bishop. It's come down to like two people, and they elect the last two by acclamation. Because they have two more spots. And so she gets elected on July 17th. She's the first bishop of the United Methodist Church. She's also the first woman bishop. She's the first woman bishop in the United Methodist Church, but she's also the first woman bishop in any major United States denomination. So it's pretty rad that this, they call her, quote, a petite gray-haired establishmentarian. Because she was like barely 5 feet. Like, she was the tiniest woman. And everybody loves her. One person wrote, it won't hurt if the first woman bishop is also somebody's grandmother. She did have a kid. She was divorced long before, but and she was a single mom while she was working on her PhD and doing all this stuff. Jeez. And so her story is just absolutely incredible. She's just like defeated all the odds and just been everybody's surprise because they just saw her as this like sweet, gentle woman, but She knew the mechanisms to get things done.
It's always the quiet ones.
It is.
And she serves for 4 years, right? Like she,
yeah, she serves remembering for 4 years.
It was almost a, we know that that Marjorie only has 4 years to serve. So if this goes horribly, it's only for 4 years.
Yeah, no, for real. Like there's a maximum age for bishops, right? So you can't turn that age during a quadrennium that you serve. So yeah, she only has 4 years. So by knowing that, of course, Leontine Kelly's name appears on the Southeast jurisdiction's ballots, but she doesn't get any traction in 1980. And so, you know, Cosroe and the clergy women know that they've got more work ahead because there's only 4 years that Marjorie Matthews can serve. And according to everybody who talks about her, that 4 years was brutal. You know, the men did, in fact, isolate her. There are stories of her taking her lunch into the bathroom and closing herself up in the bathroom and just eating alone. And so she really, like, all of the fears that Jean Audrey Powers vocalized came true. And so when they were getting ready to strategize for the next one coming up in 84, like, they tried to make sure to put women up in every single jurisdiction and to make sure that nobody would be alone.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So Leontine Kelly, also at this clergywoman's consultation in 79.
Yeah.
Also on the ballot in 1980, but in the Southeast, so it doesn't get traction. What shifts between 84 and 88 that kind of makes room for Bishop Leontine Kelly to get elected?
You mean between 80 and 84?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
yes,
between, yeah, no, this is okay.
Between 80 and 84.
It's all good. It's a lot. I keep a spreadsheet of all the women bishops when they're elected and when they serve, just so I keep myself straight. So, but you know, the first year is easy. It's like 1980, Marjorie Matthews. No, so in they have another clergywoman's consultation in 1983, Glorieta, New Mexico, and they build a strategy. And Leontine Kelly is a for sure put up on the ballot, and she does get elected in 1984. And then Judith Craig gets put up in 1984. Judith Craig was also working as part of these clergywomen consultations. And so she gets elected in 1984 in the North Central jurisdiction. Leontine Kelly is again going up in the Southeast jurisdiction, and she's not getting any traction. And so I'm glad you mentioned the West a little bit ago, because the Western jurisdiction is scheming and they're like, you know what? Leontine Kelly's name is actually pretty popular out here, and we've got a lot of folks who will vote for her. And so, you know, the elections in the Southeast. So I just want you to imagine they're meeting in Idaho, the Western jurisdiction is. The Southeast jurisdiction is meeting at Lake Junaluska, North Carolina. And they start realizing in the Western jurisdiction that they can get traction. So they call North Carolina from Boise, Idaho. And they're like, hey, Leontine, if you can get here, like, we feel sure that we can get you elected. So Leontine Kelly reportedly goes into Hutto Auditorium and basically is like, all right, fellas, it's been good. I'll see you later. Gets on a plane, flies to Boise, Idaho, where she then gets elected as the second woman bishop in the United Methodist Church, the first woman of color bishop in the United Methodist Church. She gets elected along with Roy Sano, who is the first Asian American bishop elected in the United Methodist Church. And like, it's just, it's wild to just be like, hold up. Like, this is not like I just tweeted anybody want this to happen. Like, the amount of coordination that happened, because, you know, jurisdictions only meet for like 5 days.
Yeah.
And so
they didn't have cell phones either.
No, so no.
When you say call North Carolina, I am imagining that somebody called the front desk of Lake J. It was like,
yeah. Yeah. Like, you've got the operators who are like putting people through. And it's just, yeah. And so, and then just, I mean, having been a child of the Southeast jurisdiction, right? Like walks into Stewart Auditorium is like, see you later, guys.
Like, okay, so I'm going to ask you to put on your nerdy polity hat for a second, because I know you have one. How, like, is that something that can still be done, or like, has our polity changed? Like, can one jurisdiction just elect someone from another one and just be like, yeah, we want that person over there, even if they aren't part of our conference? Like,
Yeah. It's actually, yeah. The only qualification is that you're an elder in the church, right? So, I mean, and we've been doing this, right? Because we had previously elected bishops in central jurisdictions and reassigned them into the geographical jurisdictions. And so in 84, it's not a problem. And we've been putting in interim bishops, like who are retired to fill in if somebody died or all these places. So yeah, they're available to do that. And so she didn't even have to change her conference affiliation, right? Like she came out of the Virginia conference. And so, yeah. And we've not made a rule about it since. It's just been a tradition, right? Like, because,
So. I mean, that makes me, it's like my brain is going in all of the directions now. Because that makes me really wonder then, like, why do we still have jurisdictions? Because they're always, like, the argument I have heard, right, is that they're where we elect bishops. And, like, we can, but we can't be trusted to elect them connectionally. But it sounds like we actually can, and we kind of do. It's just not, quote-unquote, tradition. That's
I mean, we elected them at General Conference up until 19...
Yeah, until 30.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, jurisdictions, I mean, this may be a comment that extends into a six-timers podcast, but like jurisdictions, aside from the Southeast and the South Central who own property, like the only function they really serve is for election of bishops. And so I'm from the Southeast. I have no problem seeing them go, but I actually think that I don't think it's going to be the Southerners that argue to keep jurisdictions.
Yeah,
because there is power in jurisdictions, right, to keep representation that may not actually be there. And the South has historically been overrepresented. But post-disaffiliation, you know, the rest are also overrepresented. So, like, you know, it's going to be an interesting conversation moving forward, of course.
Okay, so Leanne and Kelly gets this phone call, goes into Stewart Auditorium. I'm assuming then gets on an airplane and flies to
Boise, Idaho.
To Boise, Idaho. Oh my gosh.
Boise, Idaho.
There's definitely not a direct flight in 1984 from Asheville, North Carolina to Boise, Idaho.
No.
So she makes it in time. And like, does then she have to do politicking while there? Or like, does she like land and.
She lands
and. Announced.
And gets elected. Yeah. I guess they held the vote until she was there in person just to, like, you know, so that she could come up and be celebrated and she would be of the group. But yeah,
that's really cool. And then where does she serve? Where does she, what's her kind of story beyond 84?
So she gets elected in 84. She serves in the Cal Nevada conference from 84 to 88. So again, another one term bishop. Judith Craig is the first to serve multiple terms. And so she ends up, you know, she's elected in 84. She serves in Michigan for 8 years and then serves a last 8 years in West Ohio. So she had 16 to serve.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And Judith Craig, like, collected stories, like being remaining in the episcopacy for so long, like as women are elected, she collects stories and then of course publishes it in the book The Leading Women, and shares some of those. So
and so we've kind of dropped we haven't dropped Jean Audrey Powers. Is she still kind of with Cosro politicking throughout all of this?
Yeah, so she's on Cosro for her two quads, right? Like she resigns after she's been there for her terms, but she's still working in the General Church, right? She worked in the General Church for her entire time, and is working with, you know, all of this ecumenical work and with the World Council of Churches, and keeping an eye on, you know, these clergy women consultations. She retires in 1995. And when she retires, we actually learn a whole lot more about why she probably wouldn't have made it as a bishop, because she comes out as queer. Of course, when you go through, like, the people who knew her knew about her lifelong partner and asked all kinds of questions. So when you're going through all of her papers and all of the Cosro stuff, there are all these notes between her and the triumvirate who are like asking how her partner's doing and like, oh, you know, she's not going to travel for this or whatever. And so it's a known thing, but it's not like a church-wide known thing. And so, but even in retirement, she continues her work. She lives in Pilgrim Place in Claremont, California, which is like apparently like the Western, like if you're a United Methodist, you retire here and live here. And I've heard stories, one, which is my favorite, from Mark Stom, who is now retired from SMU Perkins School of Theology. And he said at one point he went to go visit her. And like, she brings him in and like, they're chatting and she's like, oh, I need to go find, let me go find that file. And she like opens up her oven, which is now like a file repository, and pulls files out of the oven.
The archival leaning part of me is screaming inside.
I know. But like, when I'm going through her papers, I'm like, I wonder if this was in the oven. But no, she kept everything. And when I say everything, can I tell you my favorite thing to find in her papers?
Yes, please.
Apparently, Jean Audrey Powers loved beauty pageants and she would make her own scorecards. And so there are some of these scorecards that are in her papers where she's written the like top 10 and like all of their things, and she scored them. And so there are notes to her like talking about like, oh, I'm sure you had this contestant, like I figured you had them. And she would share the results of like if her projections matched up with what they chose. And the wildest thing to go through is to look at that and go, what in the absolute world is this? And then you start to see the notes that she wrote to people or that they wrote to her about these. And you're like, oh God, she loved watching beauty pageants.
The beauty pageant bracket. I love this.
Like, it's just wild to me to think about like beauty pageants and like her feminism and yeah, like how like they...
The male gaze and all of this stuff.
Yes,
it seems antithetical, but...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were
like
the Miss America pageant has always been a scholarship pageant. Right. So I imagine that played in. But, you know, I'm like, OK, well, how do you rate the swimsuit category as a feminist? You know, like, yeah.
Oh, that's going to go in a trivia question somewhere. Yeah. OK, so. Like what is the, where should we leave this episode? I'm going to say it that way, right? We've gotten enough. I know, so, we're going off the rails. It's great. We've elected a bishop. We've elected a woman as bishop and a woman of color as bishop. We've learned about Jean Audrey Powers and the badassery that she was. What's the lesson here? Like, do the dominoes just start falling afterwards, or is there still something that we need to be fighting for?
Yes and yes. I think one of the things that this work from Jean Audrey and these clergywomen, like they really are elevating the importance of why Madeline Southard created the Association of Women Preachers, right? Like why those networks are needed. They show why COSRO is needed. And to me, like, oh my gosh, does a sociologist like see network theory all through this, right? Like how that these women are building these networks and then they're lifting each other up every single chance they get. Because I mean, I'm looking at my list over here, Susan Morrison, Sharon Rader, Sharon Christopher, Leontine Kelly, Marianne Swenson, Anne Brookshire, Cher Simpson, Susan Hassinger, Janice Huey, Charlene Kammer. They're all part of all of these consultations. And so people are noticing their work and lifting it up. And we haven't had, you know, once we started getting women elected, you know, I get maybe the need for the clergy women's consultation kind of, they thought maybe wasn't as important, or maybe the funds weren't there. I remember in 2018, maybe even 2019, the Southeast jurisdiction held a clergy women's consultation for the jurisdiction. And at that point, you know, we were celebrating the women bishops that we had, but we were also, there was also a space for women who felt called to step forward. And one of the women that, you know, felt that call was Connie Shelton. And then she got elected. And so I do think that there is power in this kind of networking. And I think there is power in this kind of gathering. It continues to hold us accountable, and it continues to lift up our work.
So Emily, is the Association of Women Preachers, is that still a thing that's in existence?
Yeah, it's now called the International Association of Women Ministers. But one of the things that I noticed with this organization, once denominations started creating accountability agencies, like Methodists aren't as involved because we have COSROs on, you know, jurisdiction levels and on annual conference levels and at the general church level. So, you know, a lot of women kind of lean into that for doing the work that this association once did. And, you know, it's one of these things. It's like, you know, do you want the organization to like be doing that work, or do you want it done internally? And there are pros and cons for both of these, right? But yeah, it's still an organization, still working today, still doing all kinds of things. Now, actually, one of the things Jean Audrey Powers got very frustrated with, they switched their membership to be anyone who is in ministry, not just like a preacher ordained minister. And so there's this letter in her files where she's just railing about how mad she is about this move, because she just kind of saw, you know, women preachers as this protected class with this organization that, you know, if you open it up, it muddies the waters of what some of your arguments are. But, you know, oh well.
Oh well. Well, Emily, it has been a delight again to have you on again.
Yay, thank you so much for bringing,
all of your wisdom on women preachers and Methodism and politicking, nerd
politicking. Yeah.
Not with me.
No, it's an honor. I love getting a chance to talk about these incredible women, right? Like, we're all standing on their shoulders for the work that they've done over the time. Yeah,
exactly. So everybody who's listening, please continue to support G. Cosro, because this is the legacy that they carry on. And don't keep your files in your oven. That is my
amen. or in damp basements.
Or in damp basements. Just get an acid-free box. They're on Amazon. You can find them. It's fine. To all of our listeners, thank you for joining us, and we'll see y'all next time.